Hello and welcome to another live edition of The Face of Pro-Life. Today I am with Peter Wolfgang, who is the Executive Director of the Family Institute of Connecticut. Thank you for joining us today, Peter.
Corinne, thank you for having me on.
Could you tell us a little bit about your organization? What is the Family Institute of Connecticut, and what is your major mission?
Our mission is to encourage and strengthen the family here in the state of Connecticut. We are celebrating our 20th anniversary this year. We were founded in 1989. We are the local associate of Focus on the Family, which is an evangelical Protestant organization out of Colorado. Although Family Institute of Connecticut itself is non-sectarian, and our office in Hartford actually is staffed almost entirely with Catholics. But our mission these last 20 years has been to do whatever we can to strengthen and encourage the traditional family, the marriage-based family, because children do best if they have the opportunity to be raised in a home with both their married mom and dad.
And if our children do better, then obviously our society does better.
Absolutely. You know, marriage is a pre-political, natural existing organization. It doesn't cost the society anything to prop up marriage, and marriage itself is the best institution through which society can see children be raised up to become fulfilled, productive members of society. So, you know, having a healthy marriage culture, Corinne, is in the best interests of everybody.
Now, I know recently your major goal or major mission is fighting the institution of the same-sex marriage in Connecticut, but elsewhere. Could you tell us a little bit about how this whole movement has started? You know, where did it start, and where have we come to?
Well, Corinne, it has absorbed a lot of our time over these last several years, fighting this effort to redefine marriage in the state of Connecticut and nationally as well. You asked where it came from. It's important to remember what happened right before it started, which is there was this scholarly consensus had been building in the 90s. By the 90s, we were now 20 years into the no-fault divorce revolution from the 1970s, when the marriage laws in our country were first reformed in the early 1970s to create no-fault divorce, which essentially turned into unilateral divorce. It was sold to the public as something that would be liberating, it would be good for everyone, children would be happier. I mean, there were other elements too, but that was a large part of the sales pitch. And by the 90s, it was clear they had the social science evidence. They could follow kids into adulthood, do what's called longitudinal studies that in the aggregate, you know, society was not better. Children were not happier. In fact, if children were not fortunate enough to grow up in a home with both their mom and dad, statistically, they were more likely to get involved in drugs or drop out of school or get pregnant or go to prison or any number of statistical indicators that are negative. That's not to say that if you're not fortunate enough to grow up in a home with both your mom and dad, this is definitely going to happen to you. But in general, this is what the statistics have shown. And so by the 90s, among both the left and the right, a scholarly consensus was building that children do best in a home with both their mom and dad, that the divorce revolution from the 70s had been bad for the country.
Because it made divorce so much easier.
Oh, it was terrible.
So much easier.
And I mean, it was intended to make divorce easier because they thought that everyone would be better as a result.
Right.
And by the 90s, they you know, the evidence was there to show this didn't really work out. We need to do what we can to strengthen marriage. And so there was a scholarly consensus moving in that direction. Unfortunately, and your question to me was, where did it come from, this movement for same-sex marriage? It began within the gay activist community themselves. Some of the more honest of their proponents, or perhaps more clear-sighted, have admitted openly that the real purpose of redefining marriage was to destroy the institution of marriage altogether. They viewed it as patriarchal, as heterosexist, and they were very upfront about the fact that if you can redefine marriage to include same-sex marriage, then the marriage institution itself breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I that's one way in where it came from. Another place where it came from is this other thing that we've been talking about, divorce. I mean, you know, a lot of times when we talk about how same-sex marriage is bad for marriage, our opponents come at us and say, "Oh, are you saying that gay people, homosexuals, that they're responsible for the sorry state that marriage is in America?" And of course, we're not saying that at all. What we are saying, in fact, is that no. the rest of us heterosexuals had to do this much damage to man to marriage first before something like same-sex marriage would even become thinkable.
Yeah.
I mean, when marriage became even less than the power of a contract in law, where, you know, in a contract, one person can't just unilaterally walk away with no penalties, no remedy for the partner who's still left there. Marriage is now less than a contract. It's supposed to be more. It's supposed to be a covenant, which society and in its institutions like law recognize. Instead, with no-fault divorce, we made it even less than a contract. And because marriage had taken such a battering from the 70s up through the 90s and now into the 2000s, same-sex couples felt that, you know, why not us? Right. Why not include
us? You've already made it so much less sacred than it used to be.
Right.
It might as well, you know. Yeah.
Right. And of course, you know, the question then becomes, well, if two men can get married,
yeah,
why not three men?
Yeah.
And
they don't care because they're trying to destroy marriage anyway.
Right. I mean, this is pretty much where we're headed.
Yeah.
So we oppose same-sex marriage. Because we were, you know, even before same-sex marriage popped onto the scene, we were concerned about the bad effects of divorce. We wanted to strengthen the traditional family structure, the marriage culture. And because we know that children do best in a home with both their mom and dad, and because same-sex marriage means permanent and obligatory motherlessness or fatherlessness for the children of those unions, we felt it necessary to oppose same-sex marriage. And as I said, you know, if two men can get married, why not three men?
Right.
You know, other damages done to marriage by same-sex marriage. We've seen in Scandinavian countries where the same-sex marriage agenda is further advanced, that when marriage, traditional marriage, becomes just one option among many, a sort of do-it-yourself salad bar, fewer people enter into it.
Yeah.
And that's bad for society for the reasons we've already discussed.
Yeah.
Natural marriage is the institution through which children are raised to be productive members of society. It's also been bad for religious liberty. It's been bad for parental rights, with things that have been forced on children in the schools against their parents' wishes. So for a whole variety of reasons, we felt it necessary to take up this flag and fight against the effort to redefine marriage.
Okay, so let's step back a little bit. So you say the movement kind of started in the 90s. And I mean, I recall, was it 2000 when a lot of the different states had voted whether or not they were going to allow civil unions or even same-sex marriage? And going back even a little bit further, wasn't there some kind of a Defense of Marriage Act in
Well, in 2004 was the big year.
Was it?
And there were some votes before then, but basically, in every single state where to this day in 2009, in every single state where the people have been allowed to vote on marriage, and we're talking over 40 states now, every single state where people were allowed to vote, whether it was to place a statute into the laws or to amend their state constitutions to stop the courts, in every single state where people were allowed a direct vote on marriage, they have always voted to protect marriage as between a man and a woman. Arizona, a special case. The first time around, the vote didn't pass, but then the second time it did pass. So we can say in every single state where this was put to the vote, the people have decided to protect marriage as between a man and a woman.
Even in an incredibly liberal state such as California,
yeah,
where they twice voted to keep marriage between
right.
a man and a woman.
In California, they had a direct vote in the year 2000 to put it as a statute into their laws that marriage is between a man and a woman. 2008, the California Supreme Court decides to usurp the will of the people and just single-handedly, 4-3 decision, you know, by one vote, 4 judges decide to that they're going to redefine marriage for all of California. Well, the people of California, and this is very interesting too, that vote took place in May, the Supreme Court vote in May of 2008. And what our opponents said at the time, now up till then, May of 2008, we had won just about everywhere
right.
where marriage was put to a vote. And when that happened in California, our allies there, they gathered the signatures to have it on the ballot for the next November to amend the state constitution to protect marriage
right.
as between a man and a woman, overturn the California Supreme Court. But in May of 2008, when that decision first came down, what our opponent said was, oh, you know, gay marriage, that's so 2004. It's 2008 now. People don't care about same-sex marriage anymore. Everyone's fine with marriage equality, which
right.
is their buzz phrase for this. You know, it's May 2008. What people care about right now are high gas prices.
Right.
And of course, we know what happened when November 2008 rolled around. The people did rise up. And initially, the polls showed that people in California did support the same-sex marriage ruling. But, you know, this is why not to trust polls. By the time Election Day came around, we know what the people of California really ended up thinking. And, you know, by the time Election Day came around, those high gas prices had disappeared. By Election Day 2008, now it was the market crash. I mean, there were other economic concerns. But obviously, marriage was a very big concern. And this, frankly, this is something that the political elites, especially in the Republican Party, which is supposed to be the more conservative of the two parties, should take note of. In the last election, the only conservative victories were on marriage. Were on marriage. Republican Party, take note. Democratic Party, please take note. The only conservative victories last year were on marriage. It wasn't on the Iraq War. It wasn't on any other issue under the sun. It certainly wasn't on economics. It was on marriage. And people need to know that no matter what you hear from the other side, no matter how the liberal media wants to play the events of the day, most people in this country, whether they're black, white, Hispanic, male or female, Democratic or Republican, Jewish, Catholic or Protestant, the one thing we're all agreed on, most of us, is that marriage should be between a man and a woman.
And just to be clear, so in California, the initial vote was basically a referendum saying that they wanted the marriage to remain between a man and a woman. What the court said was that is unconstitutional.
Right.
So what the people tried to do was make it constitutional by amending their constitution, and that way it is now constitutional that marriage is between a man and a woman.
Right.
Is that going to stay in California?
That's an open question. Our opponents have now taken this back to the California Supreme Court with some sophistry, some argument for why the referendum that passed last year was somehow unconstitutional because of the wording or something like that. I don't think the California court is going to go for that, because if they do, I mean, it sort of upends the entire right of initiative in the state of California, which is very rooted in California culture and politics. So I'd be very surprised if even a court as crazy liberal as California's would do that. I think the more likely scenario would be that our opponents in California are going to gather the necessary signatures to bring it back for another proposition and have another vote. And that, you know,
until they get their way.
Exactly. I mean, you know, all told on both sides, all put together, about $60 million was spent in California on this. And that was very unusual for our side. On the pro-marriage side, the pro-family side, that's the first time we've seen the emergence of real money in a race.
Yeah.
I don't know if we have it to keep doing that year after year after year. I know the other side does.
Yeah, because we have families.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. We'll see what happens.
The interesting thing that I heard after, you know, the amendment, was it Proposition 8 passed?
Yes.
One of the judges said, you know, how dare the people overturn our our will? And I'm thinking, wait a second. What do you mean, how dare the people overturn you? You overturned the people. You have no right to do that.
Wow. You know, I didn't hear that, but I can totally believe that a judge would say that. And you know what? I mean, someday you should have me back just to talk about my own. I mean, this is the sort of thing that made me a conservative. I was born and raised in the state of Connecticut. I was a liberal like everyone around me. And I was a judicial conservative before I was any other kind of conservative.
Yeah.
You know, I went to UConn Law School, which is where I met my wife. And it was studying the Roe v. Wade decision and the decisions that led up to it and came out of it. That basically led me to believe that, you know, there's something deeply un-American and anti-democratic rooted in our legal culture, this attitude of the people are essentially too stupid to govern themselves, and they need us, their black-robed masters, to do it for them. It's outrageous.
I know. So let's come back to the court. So California does not have same-sex marriage, although they did have a window of several, you know, months or a couple months that they had same-sex marriage. But Connecticut and Massachusetts do have same-sex marriage, and so does Iowa.
That's
Could you tell us a little bit about how in the world did that happen?
Well, in Vermont, too. Right now, same-sex marriage exists legally in these four states, including in our own, in Connecticut. In three of the four states, it came about through judicial fiat, through a handful of judges, you know, and it was 4-3 in Connecticut and Massachusetts, as it was in California, with just a 4-3 vote, a bare majority of judges reaching down, as I was just saying before, like there are robed masters, our philosopher kings, making this decision for all of us. In Connecticut, the one I'm most familiar with, of course, is here in Connecticut. There were a lot of twists and turns that really raised some ethical concerns about those public officials who are responsible for protecting and defending the laws of the state of Connecticut. The attorney general did not argue the case himself. It was his job to defend the marriage laws right. of Connecticut. He didn't argue the case himself, something
so
this
let's,
important.
Let's go back for a yeah. second, because a couple of years ago, I know there were thousands of people down in Hartford, and this was during the, they were discussing the civil unions.
Yes.
And they were going to allow same-sex civil unions. And I went down and I spoke with my my representative, and you know, he said, oh, well, we're going to pass the civil unions, same-sex civil unions, because, you know, it's just the right thing to do. And it's written, and I said, well, come on. The minute the ink dries, they're going to be suing in court, and the courts are going to overturn it and say that it's unconstitutional. And he says, oh, no, we've written it in a way that the courts can't possibly do that. Governor Rell said the exact same thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to sign this bill to yeah. protect marriage, because once we have civil unions, they can't go any farther. This is how the, you know, the judges cannot overturn this. So what you're saying is that then it
the
was,
judges
of course.
Just went right. I mean, they actually took the civil union law. And, you know, what people like Jody Rell, the governor, was referring to was this amendment that was attached to the civil union law specifically defining marriage as between a man and a woman. Such a clear legislative intent that, you know, if we lived in as lawless as the times we are living in, that the judges would have looked at that and said, okay, the legislature made its intent very clear, and our job as judges is merely to interpret the law, not to make law,
right.
So we need to leave it alone. That's what the governor and the rest of them meant. But we knew all along, Family Institute and many of our folks like you that were there on this, you know, we told those legislators, of course it won't happen here.
Right.
Of course the court, this is why we oppose the civil union law. We said, you know, the judges will take this and they will use it as a pretext to impose full same-sex marriage. And that's what happened. Corinne, you know, you mentioned thousands of people coming down to the state capitol. Family Institute, we gathered 100,000 signatures yeah. in 2003 and gave it to the state legislature to protect marriage. We had 6,000 people rally at the state capitol, freezing cold day in February 2004 against same-sex marriage. We had another 3,000 in 2005 to protest the civil union law passing. We had another 3,000 just last September in 2008, another 3,000. Because to protest in advance this this Kerrigan ruling that we knew was coming down.
Right.
We knew it would come down the way it did. We even knew or you know, we had strong reason to know, and we turned out to be right, that it would even be a 4-3 decision for same-sex marriage. So, I mean, we told these lawmakers this is what will happen in court. We told the judges, you need to let Family Institute intervene in this case as a defendant so that we can put on evidence and argue this case, because the attorney general, not only did the attorney general not argue the case himself, but the person he sent to argue it from his office, she did not make the only argument that has ever won in cases of this kind, which is, what is the purpose of marriage? Marriage is about procreation.
Yeah.
She refused to, that's the only argument that's ever won in cases of this kind. And instead, she limited her argument simply to, this lawsuit isn't necessary because civil unions covers their concerns.
So, Richard Blumenthal, our attorney general, who is constantly got his face out there, who is constantly battling everything from, you know, smoking in the casinos to everything.
Yeah.
Bridal shops closing down without telling the brides that they're, you know, going out of business. He did not do his job on this very, very important case.
I believe that. I said that to his face at We had a debate on Fox 61's, I think it was called Beyond the Headlines. They changed the name of the show. But Shelley Sinlin's Sunday morning show. And Blumenthal didn't take kindly to being told that. But, you know, the facts are the facts. And I would encourage everyone to read footnote 15 of Justice Zarella's dissent, where Justice Zarella pretty much, in so many words, says the same thing that I'm saying that you just said. That Attorney General Blumenthal really, really didn't do his job on the Kerrigan ruling. And here we are. And, you know, so one of the frustrating things, too, is that in order for the judges to declare homosexuals a suspect class, which is what they did in the Kerrigan ruling, one of the findings they have to make is that this group that's a suspect class, and now they need special protection, so we need to invent same-sex marriage. Suspect class is an element in law that's like similar to race.
Mm-hmm.
one of the findings that needs to be made is that this class is powerless, that they have no power.
Oh, right.
I mean, they control every
the
lever
courts.
Of power in Hartford.
I know.
I mean, they got the Attorney General Blumenthal to really not argue the case to the best of his ability
right.
or
well,
his office's
ability. Well, they have the whole judicial committee.
They have the two co-chairmen of the Judiciary Committee, openly gay champions of same-sex marriage. I mean, gay people are politically powerless at the state legislature? You've got to be kidding. It's frankly, it's a small miracle that we've managed, and we've stopped these guys every year. 2003, domestic partnership bill, we stopped it. 2005, they wanted full same-sex marriage because of our work that all they got was civil unions with a definition of marriage amendment attached. 2007, they came back for full same-sex marriage. We stopped it. Even in 2009, after the Kerrigan ruling, they wanted to pass this bill to codify Kerrigan without any amendments. We successfully attached an amendment to it last week. To protect the religious liberty of organizations in Connecticut. So we beat these guys every year at the legislature, but that hardly means that they're politically powerless.
Right,
I mean,
right.
they control every lever of power. It's only because we turned out those thousands of people in Hartford that we were able to accomplish as much as we did. And even then, at the end of the day, I mean, they had the Kerrigan case and the fix was in.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Why is it that Connecticut didn't have a referendum or a ballot initiative? Why were we like one of the only states that didn't?
Well, this is why same-sex marriage, you know, has arrived in Connecticut and the rest of New England. We talked about four states that have same-sex marriage. Three of them are here in New England because New England doesn't have direct initiative the way California and other parts of the country do. There is no mechanism in Connecticut by which the voters can vote directly on a law. Up or down, it would have to go through the legislature first. And so, you know, the closest shot we had was there was this constitutional convention question that's required to be on the ballot once every 20 years. Unfortunately, the question was not directly and unambiguously on marriage the way it was on other in other states. It was just, shall there be a constitutional
right.
convention? Our opponents knew what we wanted to do
right.
if we got a yes vote. So they brought in $1 million from out of state, most of it teacher union money, to get a no vote. We still got 500,000 votes. We still got like 41%, considering we had almost no money up against their $1 million campaign. So it shows you that there was some energy on our side for this vote, but it's, you know, it's hard to compete with that teacher union money.
And that was very confusing. I know a lot of, like you said, the opposition was trying to, you know, confuse people, but basically the Constitutional Convention are the people who wanted to revisit the Constitution basically wanted to be able to have that put into our Constitution, the idea that we can call for referendums
yeah.
like other states do. And I don't think that was, obviously we didn't get that message out because a lot of people, I think, were just confused that people were going to put all sorts of things in the Constitution.
It would have taken more money, much more money. I mean, we just talked about the reason we won in California was the emergence of real money.
Mm-hmm.
Even the fact that we successfully amended SB 899, the same-sex marriage codification bill, Family Institute placed full-page ads 3 days in a row in every daily newspaper
yeah.
in Connecticut, and that didn't come
cheap.
They
were really
yeah.
good ads.
Thank you.
Maybe they should have taken out the Constitution Convention
yeah.
ads.
yeah. Well, and I'll tell you, excuse me, we had great allies. We had the Knights of Columbus involved.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a team effort with a lot of different groups. And we generated 20,000 phone calls
wow.
to the legislature. And that's why there was so much pressure, especially coming off of this other fight we had just a month ago on SB 1098, which was this crazy bill introduced in the legislature to forcibly restructure the governing of the Catholic Church, the internal governing of the church. And people were still very upset about that.
Right.
And legislators were still very scared of the reaction of that and very sensitive to any suggestion that they're against religious liberty.
Right.
So you combine that with our 20,000 phone calls that our newspaper ads and some other stuff generated, and you get the victory that we got on SB 899 last week.
So do you think that that was kind of a ploy, the 1098, the attack on the Catholic Church, to kind of wear people out? You know what I mean? Like if we get them all worked up about this, we, you know, then maybe they won't get as worked up of as another thing. You know, like they'll put all their energies in this basket.
I don't know. That's one possibility. You know, the two guys who are very likely behind 1098, as they are behind same-sex marriage, Representative Lawler from East Haven, Senator McDonald from Stamford, they are those two both openly gay same-sex marriage advocates who are co-chairmen of the Judiciary Committee that I mentioned earlier. Given the long history with them, we all, and Bishop Lurie said this openly, that Bill 1098 seemed like it was payback against the Catholic
right.
Church for opposing same-sex marriage. But the theory that you just threw out there that, you know, it, was this to drain our, you know, divert our energy so that we weren't focused on the real threat, 899, it may be that that was their intention. I don't know. But if so, it backfired horribly because we were able to use that energy
yeah.
from 1098 and channel it to forcing an amending of 899. And I don't, you know, honestly, if Lawler and McDonald had not screwed up so badly on 1098, I don't know that we would have
even gotten the amendment.
Yeah. I mean, they kind of inadvertently helped us. And,
yeah.
you know, it was I think they miscalculated badly, very badly. There was so much energy on amending SB 899 that even Lawler and McDonald had to vote for it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Is there any way that we can find out how our own legislators voted on that bill?
Yes, go to the Family Institute of Connecticut website. It's ctfamily.org. We will have that voter scorecard up in a few days. And I want to tell people the key vote is not the final vote on SB 899, because our goal wasn't really to stop that bill. Stopping that bill wouldn't have stopped same-sex marriage in Connecticut, because it's the Kerrigan decision
right.
from last October. And even it's not Amendment A, which was the amendment to protect the religious liberty of organizations in Connecticut, because as you see, we brought so much pressure to bear that even Lawler and McDonald ended up voting for that. I mean, almost everybody voted for Amendment A. The amendment you want to watch for, and we'll have this up on our website in a few days, Family Institute, working through Senator Witkos in the Senate and Representative Cafaro in the House, we brought up another amendment to require that parents be notified ahead of time if so-called gay-friendly curricula is being taught in the schools and be given the opportunity to opt out their children. That was voted down.
Now, that's something that parents really should be wary of, because they're already doing this in Massachusetts. So tell us a little bit about the Massachusetts law and how you know, this is affecting children in their education.
In Massachusetts, we have the very interesting case of a man named David Parker, who is an evangelical Christian man, father of a five-year-old boy, didn't want his boy being taught about same-sex marriage from this book in the boy's kindergarten class. And, you know, prior to same-sex marriage, there was an opt-out thing in the law.
Sure.
So he called the school and he was like, look, just let me know when this is being taught ahead of time, because I want to take my boy out that day. They refused to do that. And he had a fruitless, like, telephone and
email
exchange with school officials for the better part of a year. Finally went down to the school and said, look, I'm not leaving until you give me that guarantee. Instead of giving him a very simple guarantee to protect his child, they called the police, had him arrested. The man spent a night in prison for trying to protect his son from a book that promoted same-sex marriage
yeah.
in kindergarten. There was another couple, the Worthlands, very similar situation. Their child was in second or third grade. They filed a lawsuit to have this book, you know, for the right not to have this book forced on their child. The lawsuit was dismissed, the judge said, because now that Massachusetts allows same-sex marriage, the state has a rational interest in fostering its acceptance.
So it's not controversial anymore.
It's
according to the school system,
right.
it's not controversial. Like,
or
even education.
Even if it is controversial, the state government, and through its apparatus, the public schools, has a duty to force it to not be controversial.
Right.
If you don't like it, that's too bad. You're a bigot. We're going to force your kids to be taught against your will. Right. And that's what our amendment, our other amendment, was trying to prevent in Connecticut. So I would say when you go to the Family Institute's website, look for that vote. That's the vote that counts. That's the vote that we're going to be talking a lot about as we head into the next election.
Excellent. We would like to open the phone lines so that you can call and ask Peter your questions. Our phone number here is 456-3000. Again, that's 456-3000. We look forward to hearing from you. So Massachusetts was the first state, and that was done by judicial fiat.
Right.
Connecticut was the second. And California
was the second, but it was overturned.
Right.
So I guess you could say Connecticut was the second.
And then just recently, two other states have come on board. So,
Iowa and Vermont.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about Iowa, because it's a similar situation.
Well, Iowa was similar to all the other places we've seen where same-sex marriage came about. The people voted against it. The Iowa Supreme Court, on their own authority, just said, you know, we're smarter than you, and we're going to force this on you whether you like it or not. That's what happened in Iowa. The only thing that was different in Iowa, I mean, a lot of people are, you know, kind of surprised because Iowa's the heartland.
Yeah.
You expect it on the coast. To me, it's the same old story of judges thinking they're smarter than the people.
Because
just
the people
holding
in
the
Iowa
people
are really
in contempt.
Stupid, you know?
Yeah, right. The only thing that jumps out at me that was different in Iowa is that for the first time, it was a unanimous decision. Yes, everywhere else it had been 4-3.
Wow.
And then the real kicker was Vermont. For the first time, same-sex marriage came about through the legislative process, through the state legislature, and not by judicial fiat. And, you know, that should be of great interest to us here in Connecticut. When Vermont did that, it makes it a sad day for
sure.
The nation that Vermont did that. But people in Connecticut should pat themselves on the back because
that
was supposed to be us.
Yeah.
The national gay movement targeted
Zeroed
Connecticut.
In.
The group that promotes same-sex marriage in Connecticut, Love Makes a Family, and they're now going out of business because we believe they were really just a beachhead for the national gay movement. Connecticut had such a liberal legislature, and it was so protected,
right,
immune from public opinion that they said, you know, that legislature, we need a same-sex marriage win somewhere that doesn't come through the courts, that comes through the legislature. Connecticut, we've chosen you to be the first. You're the most likely, the softest target. They poured tons of money into Connecticut through this one group, Love Makes a Family. And at the end of the day, it still came about only through judicial fiat. And now Love Makes a Family is closing up its doors. They say, oh, well, we've won. But they haven't won. They got same-sex marriage, but not the way they really
wanted
it.
Right.
It wasn't Love Makes a Family. It was this other group, GLAAD, through the courts that got it. So, you know, people in Connecticut should really pat themselves on the back because Vermont was supposed to be us. Connecticut was supposed to be Vermont. And it's because of all the people that rose up, you know, all those thousands of people who rallied, called their legislators, that it never came about through the legislature.
Now, let's go back a little bit. Further, what is the national law is that marriage is between a man and a woman. So if a man and a man marry in Connecticut, they can't file married taxes, right? I mean, to the IRS.
As of this very moment, this is true. I've been busy with some other things today, and you may know better than me, but it's my understanding that Arlen Specter in the Senate today has jumped from the Republican
Yes.
Party to the Democratic Party. And I may be wrong about this. I hope I am wrong, but I think the Senate Republicans may have just lost their filibuster number.
I think it's close, but
okay.
it's not
All right,
total.
Because if the Senate Republicans lose their ability to filibuster, I mean, what's going to happen is Obama and the Democratic Congress are going to try to overturn the Defense of Marriage Act, and then everything's up for grabs.
Wow.
And it probably will come about. In fact, I would say our U.S. Supreme Court is maybe one vote away from Roe v. Wade for gay marriage.
Now, that, you know, people, I think, people understand how Roe v. Wade came about and how this will affect the gay marriage issue as well. But we do have a caller. It's Sheila from Ashford. Hello, Sheila.
Yes.
Did you have a question or comment?
Yes, I have a comment. I don't know why through all this same-sex education that's going on in the schools that it isn't taken into consideration the development of sexual phases. I have an article here, and you can find it on the site Sexology.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like .swami, SWAMI-center.org. And there's an article here, and it's not by any religious person or anything, but they explain the first primitive signs of reproductive system activity is observed in infants, and it's triggered by, you know, pain, laughing, whatever. then, and that's pre-emotional sexuality. The second phase is known as the adolescent intersexuality period that takes place from 7 to 9 and 15 to 17. At this age, I'm just going to read it because I don't want to, you know, do it wrong. The age generation of, at this age, generation of androgens, male sex organisms, increases. Androgens are universal regulators of sexual attraction at the endocrine level system in both sexes. Influences of androgen leads to intensification of sexual manifestation, especially in boys. What is typical of this phase is the absence of a distinct sexual orientation towards representatives of the opposite sex of own biological species, which can be attributed to the immaturity of the corresponding brain structures. Yes, we're teaching them that that's okay.
Yeah.
A sexual arousal at this stage can be easily induced by inadequate stimuli, including inanimate objects, animals, and representatives of own sex. It shouldn't be regarded as a pathology. It's the development of the brain, and this is to which the lack, it says, into conditioned reflexes, to which the lack of information about normal sexual relationships of adult people is conducive, may lead to the inversion of the person's sexual orientation for the rest of his life.
Wow.
It should be noted that it is during the first instances of emotional sexual arousal that exceptionally strong conditioned reflex ties form. So that means teaching children at a young age, and now they're doing it starting in kindergarten all the way up to high school, they haven't even totally developed their sexual part of the brain that puts them in a heterosexual relationship. So if they're told it's okay and they experiment with this, they may never go back. It will stay with them, and that's the attraction they will have. That's basically what this article is saying. I remember back when I was, you know, I'm a little bit older now, back when I was a teenager, and it was like a stigma to be attracted to the same person. And I was, you know, I was a little worried that I was, you know, am I a lesbian? And, you know, because I had friends, and, you know, but I didn't think about it a lot. It was just afraid of it. And I am the most heterosexual person. You know, I'm very heterosexual. I didn't start, you know, there was no teaching of this
right
in the schools that it was okay. In fact, in the medical books, it was taught as a disorder.
Wow.
It really is a disorder because animals don't do this. They have the same forms of development, but they initially go to the opposite sex,
right,
just the way humans are supposed to. But we have to wait till the brain, you know, forms itself completely. And that's usually not for men. Men are slower, apparently.
Yeah.
That it says it's an immaturity of the corresponding brain structures. And that goes all the way up to 17. And then the next phase is the adult sexual phase. So they're totally ignoring this process, and they are really hurting children by doing this.
You know, on this question of homosexuality being a disorder,
I could hang up now.
It was in the early 70s where the psychological associations removed it as a disorder, and one of the doctors who was key in making that happen, a Dr. Spitzer, now repudiates his earlier position. He says that he's done more research, and as a matter of fact, people who are homosexuals can change their orientation.
I to the point of Sheila, which was a great point, is I object to schools teaching kids about sexuality at all, whether it's homosexual or heterosexual, because, like she said, they're not ready, they're not mature enough, and you're basically abusing your children by even teaching them things that they're not ready for. And, I mean, many studies have been shown that children who understand or learn about sex before their mature, you know, their level of maturity is ready for it, they do worse in school because they've got all these like crazy thoughts in their heads, and they're not concentrating on what they're supposed to be concentrating on, and that is, you know, learning the basics of their classes. And so she makes a great point, and I find it ludicrous that we're talking about sex with our kids at all before, you know, eighth or ninth grade.
Oh yeah, I mean she went right to the heart of it, which is that, you know, it makes it more likely that the child's going to be open to things that the child might not otherwise be open
to. Absolutely.
And that's what they're trying to do.
Exactly.
I mean, they're trying to remove the what the rest of us would understand as the moral truth is
right.
about these things, and they're trying to come between the parents and the child, and it's just a horrible, horrible
and
thing.
And remove the stigma before
right.
they even
remove
get to
stigma.
That point.
Yep. Yep.
At that point of maturity. We have another caller, Sue from Franklin. Hello, Sue.
Hi. I was calling to find out if you could explain with a little more detail the organizations that would be protected by the amendment that was passed
oh,
with Bill
question.
899. Just to explain a little bit so that people understand who's protected, what organizations. And also,
from.
If you could explain how you went about meeting with the senators before the bill was passed to try to promote the amendment that would protect the religious liberties.
Let's take that question about organizations first. Just by way of example, things that we've seen in other jurisdictions. In Massachusetts, Catholic Charities in Boston had provided adoptions to needy children for the better part of about 100 years. Same-sex marriage comes to Massachusetts, and the state government tells Catholic Charities, you can no longer do adoptions unless you place some of those children in homes with same-sex couples. Rather than violate their conscience, they got out of the business. So basically, the state government forced Boston Catholic Charities out of the adoption gotcha. Business because of same-sex marriage-related issues. In New Jersey, a Methodist organization owned a beachfront pavilion. Lesbian couple wants to do their commitment ceremony at the pavilion. New Jersey Methodist organization says no, and because of it, the state government took away tax-exempt status
wow.
over that pavilion.
Wow.
In Canada, British Columbia, the Knights of Columbus are approached by a lesbian couple that at first were dishonest. They presented themselves as if they were mother and daughter. They wanted to rent a hall for a wedding ceremony. Eventually, it comes out that it's a lesbian wedding ceremony. Knights of Columbus refused to rent the hall for that purpose. They're sued. They ended up having to pay a fine. Your caller's question was, what organizations are protected under this amendment? Because we passed this amendment last week, what happened to Catholic Charities in Boston, the New Jersey Methodist Church, the Knights of Columbus Hall in Canada, these things cannot happen now in Connecticut. Yeah. And prior to last week, because of the Kerrigan ruling, religious liberty was just wide open to all these sorts of
wow.
attacks.
So actually it was a victory to have this 899 pass.
It was a victory. We walked out of last week with things we didn't have before last week. Some of the protections that we lost under the Kerrigan ruling have now been restored. It was a victory.
But they still can talk about homosexuality in the schools.
Well, and here's the other thing. We restored the religious liberty of organizations. We did not restore the religious liberty of individuals.
Of students.
So,
yeah.
for instance, in New Mexico, there was a photographer who was fined by the state government because she didn't want to give her services to a same-sex ceremony. Unfortunately, that our amendment does nothing for her if she ran into the same problem in Connecticut. Catholic Charities in Boston, the Methodist Church with its pavilion in New Jersey, the Knights of Columbus Hall in Canada, we've stopped those things from happening in Connecticut. The New Mexico photographer, we
SOL,
did not stop.
Yeah.
That could theoretically happen here in Connecticut.
Yeah.
And then the other problem is this business of what's going to be taught in the schools.
Yeah.
So we definitely won a victory last week. We definitely walked out of that with protections restored, with things that we didn't have before that amendment because of the Kerrigan ruling. With that amendment, things are now restored. But it wasn't a perfect win, and there's still more
right.
work to be done.
Right. We have another caller. Do we still have Mike on the line? Mike from Lebanon?
Yes.
Hi, Mike.
There's a question. Not only applies to Connecticut, but the country as a whole. I was just wondering if Mr. Nystrom thought that all this judicial system and the legislators and those special interest groups are all kind of out there waving and wagging their tongues and waving their right hand around just to get everybody to watch what the right hand's doing so that they can do what they really want to do with the left hand, like the old Houdini principle.
Well, there's all sorts of shenanigans happening all the time. There's always things going on behind closed doors. We try to keep a close eye on these guys. Just by way of a for instance, you know, we've talked mostly about SB 899. That was the same-sex marriage codification bill. We touched briefly on SB 1098. That's what I call the bishop removal bill. there was another bill, the transgendered special rights bill. These are folks who are cross-dressers or have had sex change operations. They tried to pass that bill in the Judiciary Committee. Family Institute was the only organization to fight this bill. We generated thousands of emails to the state capitol against this bill. And what happened is, because we turned up the heat, they took the language of that bill and they tried to sneak it into another bill.
Wow.
And we got wind of it, and we were able to filibuster it so that they ran out of time and they couldn't pass that bill. And, you know, the joke around the office was, we stopped the transgender bill even after they tried to dress it up as another bill. So they're always doing stuff, but we're trying to keep an eye on them.
Yeah, it's tough because it's one thing to have to try to, you know, persuade millions and millions of people to vote a special way, but it's so much easier to get to a handful of judges, you know.
And right.
It's crazy.
You know, everyone listening should know, this is where the Family Institute of Connecticut comes in, and I would encourage everyone to go to our website at ctfamily.org. We are the eyes and ears of the good, faithful people of the state at the state capitol. We're the ones who let you know what the other side's up to, what sort of sneaky attacks on our values they're going to launch. We're the early warning system.
Very good.
Okay, you're doing a good job, too.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for your call.
Thank you. Bye.
We have another caller, Louise from Colchester. Hello, Louise. Hello, Louise.
Hi, is this Darlene?
This is Corinne.
Oh, this is Louise Murray.
And did you have a question for Peter Wolfgang?
No, I just wanted to compliment him on his work.
Oh, thank you very much. I'll tell you, please pray for me, and everyone listening, pray for me, because, you know, I am human, and I do need to hear that there are people out there who support what we're doing. You wouldn't believe some of the hate mail that arrives at my inbox.
Oh, you know you're
inbox.
Doing a good job then.
Yeah, absolutely. And now through the magic of Facebook, now old friends from high school who I haven't talked to in 20 years, in-laws, now I get to hear it from everyone.
Well, Peter, I totally support what you do. And I do pray for you. I really pray for your mission. And you wouldn't be attacked if you weren't doing God's work.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, somebody out there has to be protecting the family unit as God intended. And you're keeping Catholics informed on matters of family and political that jeopardizes the family unit. And I appreciate that.
Thanks very much.
And, you know, I mean, and I think it's a time, and I've called actually certain politicians at home, and I've told them that they really need to focus on, you know, the unemployment rate, healthcare issues, things that really physically and psychologically harm the health and well-being of Connecticut citizens, instead of going after some kind of tactical warfare against goodness and kindness. And, and Peter, without people like you, you know, the family unit and respect for the family unit would be totally lost.
Thank you so much. You know, I sometimes think of that scene from the book of Genesis where Abraham tried to bargain with God and said, well, if there's just 10 people in Sodom, I mean, it's people like your caller and the other people watching our program. I sometimes think like they're the only thing kind
holding
of
holding you up.
Yeah, yeah.
the other question, we kind of go back to the judiciary, the judicial system, and the fact that right now the federal law is a defense of marriage, the Defense of Marriage Act, but we do not have an amendment. We do not have an amendment to our Constitution saying that, you know, marriage is between a man and a woman.
That's our ultimate goal.
And that probably isn't going to happen with this administration. And you said that they might even overturn the DOMA.
Right.
Do you think it's going to be by legislative process that same-sex marriage comes to all the states, or do you think it's going to be like Roe v. Wade, where the courts pretty much?
I think it's entirely possible that you'll get a sort of gay marriage Roe v. Wade. If Obama gets to replace just one conservative justice with a liberal on the U.S. Supreme Court, I think that may well happen. I don't think legislatively that Congress would vote for same-sex marriage. What Congress would do is they would repeal the Defense of Marriage Act so that it's easier for the four states that have same-sex marriage for couples to go from those states to the other 46 states
and
launch lawsuits demanding that. And that's what the Defense of Marriage Act theoretically is holding back. So you remove the Defense of Marriage Act, and then what you could have, instead of one big, you know, Roe v. Wade from the U.S. Supreme Court, you get 46 junior league Roe v. Wades from all the state Supreme Courts. Mm-hmm. I think something like that could happen.
So the idea is that, you know, it would be political suicide for them to say, you know, open gay marriage, you know, throughout the 50 states.
They won't do that.
They won't do that because
they've
seen.
But they'll do something sneaky. Remember one of your callers was like, you know, they want you to look at the right hand so you don't know what the left hand's doing. This is the way they'll do it.
So we got to keep an eye on that. So we do not want them to repeal DOMA. And obviously the other thing is to keep an eye on the Supreme Court, because all they need is one a couple from one of the states, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont, or Iowa, just come forward. We do not get to file our taxes jointly, and, you know, this is unconstitutional, right, and blah, blah, blah.
If the Republican minority in the Senate does not filibuster any sort of overturning of DOMA, then they're worthless, basically.
Yeah, well,
I mean, this is... Yeah, but they're
more
even
worthless
more worthless
than
we are. I mean, that and any sort of overturning of the Hyde Amendment, you know, to try to force us to pay for abortions more than we already do.
Right.
These are the things we have to watch out for.
We have another call from Lisa in New London. Hello, Lisa.
Hello.
Hi. Did you have a question?
First of all, thank you again for everything that you're doing. And my question is, as an educator, when I heard you mention that some of the NEA money was being used to support some of these bills that, as a teacher, I personally don't support, and I know many of us don't. I'm wondering, first of all, I wanted to let you know how incensed I am as an educator. Second of all, I'm wondering if you have any advice for me or for other educators who don't want our union money to go to organizations that support things such as gay marriage, which honestly, in my opinion, stands against what we are aiming for, you know, teaching our children to be good citizens. Do you have any advice for things that we can do to get our money allocated to something like the Family Institute of Connecticut?
Ha.
Lisa, that is such an awesome question. Immediately off the top of my head, I'm not aware of any sort of maybe reformist organization within the NEA that's fighting this sort of thing. You've got the wheels turning right now in my head. I'm thinking about this. There ought to be some sort of organization within the NEA that fights this, that's trying to do battle with the leadership, saying, look, we don't want our money spent on this. And, you know, it's worth mentioning, the teacher union money that came into Connecticut, the assumption was, because this was about the Constitutional Convention, the assumption was, well, maybe this money was coming in here because they're concerned that if you open up the Constitution, they could lose binding arbitration.
Right.
Except that the teachers' unions were also big donors to the Vote No on Prop 8 campaign in California,
right,
which was directly, completely, unambiguously about gay marriage and nothing else. So the teachers' unions are very ideologically invested in this. You asked me a great question.
I have no idea why.
Right. I mean, but you asked me a great question about, you know, what can be done. And unfortunately, immediately off the top of my head, I'll have to think about that and maybe try to get something up on our website, see if we can't investigate that. You know, it's funny, and all the time I've been fighting this stuff, that's the first time a teacher's come to me and said, you know, I don't want my money to go to this. What can I do about it? But
right. I can tell you that I'm not the only one. So if you need an advocate from the inside, I'd love to hook up.
I hope, you know, talk to the screener if you can after this call and give us like your full name and your number, and we may be in touch with you.
Thank you. Will do.
Thank you, Lisa.
We have a phone call from Brian in Baltic. Hello, Brian.
Hi.
Hi.
I was calling to say thank you to Corinne and to Peter for all your work you're doing. But Peter, I had a quick question for you. I don't know if you've heard of down in Washington. I know your efforts are mostly in Connecticut. But there's a bill, H.R. 1913, down in Washington. It's being proposed as a quote-unquote hate, you know, hate speech. speech hate crime law, and they're trying to protect 30 different classes of sexual orientation.
Wow.
Including...
There's 30?
Yeah, I know. Crazy. It's crazy stuff. I am aware of it, not as aware as I am of legislation that's pending here in Hartford. But I, you know, what this caller brings up is very important, and all the faithful need to know that this sort of stuff is coming down the pike in Washington, D.C. Things have taken a very nasty turn in our country since the last election, and the values we hold dear are under attack. And, you know, I keep coming back to that one caller who said they want you to look at the right hand so you don't know what the left hand is doing. We need to be very alert to this hate crimes legislation. This stuff needs to be stopped. Anything that attacks our free speech, which is what this is really about. Right. I mean, these folks, you know, they invent new constitutional rights out of thin air, right to abortion, right to same-sex marriage. But the real rights that have actually been there, that the founders put in the Constitution from day one, the right to free speech, the right to assembly, the right to bear arms, the right to free exercise of your religion, they come up with this with goofy ideas like hate crimes as a way of trying to take those rights away from you. And we need to do whatever we can to fight this stuff.
I'd like to say, too, that it is not hateful to try to protect your children or try to protect your society from things that you know are innately wrong. You know, it's up to us to help each other get to heaven. And if we know in our hearts and, you know, our heart of hearts, we know that homosexuality, you know, the act of homosexuality is innately wrong, and it's going to keep people from getting to heaven, it's only loving for us to protect those people and protect our children from, you know, becoming homosexuals. And it's not hateful. It's the most loving thing to stand up for not just yourself, but for your family and other people. So we're not doing it out of hate. Definitely not out of hate. We're doing it out of love.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, Family Institute, and we've always stuck to that message that it's about love, it's not about hate, it's about protecting marriage, it's about what's best for children, it's not about being against homosexuals. We gathered 3,000 people in Hartford last September with that message. The media didn't cover it at all.
Wow.
You've heard of this guy, Fred Phelps, who goes around saying really horrible things about gay folks with his rallies, that God hates them, and he uses,
yeah, no,
you know, words that I wouldn't even use on television. This guy was in Hartford today, and there's a big article about it in The Current.
All by himself?
Yeah, well, him and his family. And this gets lots of coverage in the media, but the 3,000 people that we had preaching love last September, you saw nothing on it.
Right, and that only distracts from the real issue. And like I said, I mean, people like yourself and people that come down to protect the family unit and to protect society in general, doing it out of love and not because they hate any person or any group of people. And that type of person that does do stuff like that is only detracting from it. And we need to speak out against these people and stop them from giving the Family Institute of Connecticut and other supporters of the family unit a bad name.
Absolutely.
So where are you guys going from here? I mean, you're not going to fold up like Love Makes a Family.
Well, the failure of the school's amendment is very, very interesting to us. We're very upset about it. We're not going to let that go. And I think the next battle now is to have that fight over what's happening inside the schools. We got to protect the children from, you know, that one woman who called with all the medical data about how this harms children. That's really going to be the next big fight.
So what you're looking for is possibly people who experience issues in the school, or their kids experiencing these issues, to contact you so that you have information about what is going on.
Yes.
And the battle lines.
A lawsuit's not out of the question. We're looking at every angle.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It was really interesting to have you. Thank you for joining us. We hope that you've learned something. We hope that you talk to your family and friends about the things that you've learned. Go visit the Connecticut Family Institute of Connecticut's website at ctfamily.org. And we hope when you look in the mirror the next time, you'll realize yours too is the face of pro-life. Join us again next time.